This is Earl Bell from On the Couch. Based on the overwhelming response from our last episode, we have decided to replay it again tonight. Please join us again next week at 8 p.m. for another live episode of On the Couch.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your hosts, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
Here we are, another episode of On the Couch, and welcome, and we're glad you're listening. I wanted to say one thing about tonight's episode. If you are a regular listener, you know that we usually take calls. However, tonight we are going to forego taking calls so that we can pay attention to our guest and what they have to say and their message. My name is Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
And I'm Benny Massey, LPCC, and you are on the couch.
Tonight we're going to explore a subject that is somewhat difficult at times for some people to discuss. And we have two guests here who are going to basically lead the discussion because they are very knowledgeable in the subject and have a lot to say, and they are very informed on what we're going to be discussing.
So first, let me introduce you to our two guests and let them tell a little bit about themselves. We have a colleague and friend here, David Ianke, LCSW, and we have Zach, we'll just say his first name. They're both here to give us information and for us to question. So would you all like to say a little something about yourself?
Well, we appreciate you having us tonight. I'm Dave Ianke, LCSW LMFT, have my master's in educational psychology, and it's great for me to be here with my buddy Zach tonight to talk about depression and suicide, a topic that, in my opinion, people care a lot about, but when it comes to talking about it, there's a lot of fear, and we appreciate you having us on to get this out in the open.
So I'm Zach. I'm going into my senior year of high school, and I've obviously had experience with the subject of depression and suicide, and I'm excited to get to talk about it on the show. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming, Zach. How old are you, sir?
I am 17 years old.
17 and finna graduate. You got one more year, two more years?
One more year, going into my senior year.
Okay, congratulations.
So, Zach, you say you're 17, and I guess one thing that a lot of people listening might think, wow, he's a teenager. What does he know about depression? You know, a lot of people think, well, they're just teenagers going through moods and like that. How would you explain depression from your perspective as a teenager to those people who might be saying that?
It's very up and down. It's very moody. You can be happy one moment, and for no particular reason, the next moment, you're very down, you're upset. A lot of things that I relate to it as well is like in terms of it kind of being a hair trigger. It's like, the slightest thing can set you off. And I think part of it too for me is like, for most people, like they're generally happy and they have like small moments of sadness in their life. For me, it's kind of the opposite. So it's like, for the most part, I'm generally sad or upset, and then it's the opposite. So you have brief moments of happiness instead of those brief moments of sadness.
Dave, I know you're the clinician in the group. Could you please explain kind of what Zach touched on, how depression is more than just like an episode of being sad? Can you help our listeners understand the difference?
Well, the difference for me would be, we all are going to have bouts of sadness. And on the spectrum, there's sadness to depression. And I think we're all on that spectrum somewhere. A sadness is kind of that down feeling that, you know you're sad, you know it'll get better. And you mull through it, so to speak. Depression is, in many ways, a paralysis. Yeah. I mean, it just takes you to your knees to the point where people may be, hey, just come on, come out with me, and hey, do this, do that. And, we know that. But when you're in that deep depression, dark paralysis, if you will, it's immobilizing.
No, I enjoy it. I like the way you phrase that in terms of it being paralysis. It really is. It's almost like you're paralyzed in a certain sense, in the fact that it almost shuts down your ability to do certain things. And sometimes it shuts down the way you think. You become very clouded in your mind. You don't see things very clearly. And that's why, you know, it can lead to poor decisions. And that's why I think depression and anxiety and things of that sort as well can lead into other poor choices, whether it's, you know, drugs or things like that, because you're kind of looking for that outlet elsewhere because of, I like that. It can be very paralyzing. Yeah.
Do you think, Zach, that a lot of people suffer from this? I wouldn't personally think that a lot of people, young people, suffer from depression. Maybe it's just sadness. You hear people say, get over it, move through it.
Yeah.
You're just sad. But I've seen more and more clients who do come in and say that they're depressed.
And also, I think to build on what Benny said, you know, you're young, you've got the rest of your life ahead of you. What do you have to be depressed over? How often do you hear that? And what's your response to that type?
So that's something that I definitely hear a lot, especially with, you know, the school that I go to, the house that I live in. It's something that you often hear, like, oh, you know, you're a privileged young man, you know, you can push through it, you're going to be fine, you should be happy in life, what do you have to worry about, things like that. I think my response to that really is those things don't really account, I think, for the emotional trauma, I think is a big part of it. It's like those physical aspects. You know, the house, the school, things like that. And also, you know, having the rest of my life to look forward to. You know, I'm young. I have a lot of opportunities, things like that. I don't really think those opportunities, as much as it's nice to look forward to them in the future, when you're very depressed, you get very negatively focused on the current moment. So it's very difficult to look into the future when you're struggling with what you're dealing with now. It's like if you're trying to push through the next day, like every single day you wake up, you're like, okay, how am I going to get through this? You're not really thinking about, oh, I got 10 years from now, everything's going to be okay. You don't really think that.
Well, or I'll think, you know, and take it where Zach's coming from, and Benny, it's very out there in the teenage world now. Depression leading to suicide, the research, the statistics support all this. But we're living in a time, too, where, as Zach, you know, kind of said, and coming from Earl, that, well, you have all this going for you. What do you have to be depressed about? And I think that's where we lose the conversation. I think that's where we are not having the conversations like we're having now, because young men like Zach could be in a position where, well, you know, what do I have to be sad about? And then he doesn't talk about it, and then we see where we go.
Do you think that kind of, like you're talking about, wow, what do I have to be depressed about, when people start saying that to you, that it kind of builds on the depression? Does it make your depression a little deeper and darker?
I think it does, because I feel like it makes you feel more and more alienated. It kind of makes you feel more separated, more alone, because it's like, okay, that's just one more person that doesn't understand. That's one more person that kind of wants to brush it to the side and not really look at it as seriously as it is. So it kind of, best word's discouraging, I think.
My question is, and seeing that I treat a lot of people with depression, but I'm seeing more youth with it, would you contribute it to lack of interaction, increase of social media, increase of video games, and the departure of face-to-face interaction?
I think that I think social media plays a big role, because I think with social media, a lot of it is false images. It gives a lot of false representations of a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what you see on social media a lot of times is not the reality of life. You know, in terms of relationships between people, in terms of expectations about life. A lot of times on social media, too, the thing is, even if somebody is depressed, on social media, they're going to post happy pictures. So it makes you feel like, okay, there's less and less people that feel the same way I do. Like, look, that person's happy. Well, you don't really know if that person's happy or not. So I think social media plays a big role. I think the breakdown of family units, I think, is a big part in terms of that. I know it's played a big role on me. I know it does on a lot of others.
Well, now also a lot of family members, adults, are on social media.
Right.
So now, even though, you know, the family's together, they're not together because they're doing their own thing on their social media.
I think we look for that golden answer to what causes depression, and there's not one. I think it's a percentage of a pie. Social media definitely playing a role, as Zach says. People portray them, you know, people portray themselves in a way that they're not. And one thing we know about depression, talking about it, face-to-face with people, being able to trust and be there, you know, right there with that person when they're talking. And social media is driving that further and further apart. So that human interaction is becoming less as depression becomes more.
And I think to add on to that, I think another problem in terms of human interaction is when you're suffering from depression, you often push away people that you love and care about. Because when the walls kind of start to come up, you feel, and part of it too is when you feel that bad, sometimes you just want to feel alone. Because it's like getting other people involved often makes it worse for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of other people don't know how to respond to it. And when they don't know how to respond to it, normally it leads to negative consequences or outcomes. So, I mean, you tend to kind of avoid other people when you feel that bad. And when you do push away the people that care, it makes you feel worse because then you kind of look at, oh, maybe they don't care. Well, they might,
mm-hmm.
but you're pushing them away. So, you know, that's part of it too is, you know, the people that do love and care about you, you often end up pushing away, which doesn't
mm-hmm.
improve your situation.
Mm-hmm.
So how have your friends reacted when you approach them and let them know that you're suffering from depression? How do they respond to that?
I think it depends on the person. I think it depends on the friend. But, like, in terms of my friends, I think at first it was a little bit of initial shock because, you know, as much as it's not something that I necessarily wanted to be that way, I often kind of put on a mask around other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of pretending to be happy when you're not, you know, joking around, having fun. But, I mean, that's not really how you feel inside. So I think for them it was kind of a shock because that's not really, quote unquote, you know, the Zach that they knew, I think
mm-hmm.
you could say. I think part of it, too, was for some people, I think it was also a lack of knowing, like a lack of knowing that I was going through it, but also a lack of understanding. And I think another part of it, too, was not seeing it as serious as it was,
mm-hmm.
especially amongst teens and, like, you know, younger adults and younger people in general. I think it's more of seen as it's looked down upon. Like, oh, they don't really have that. Like, you know, they're young. What do they really have to worry about?
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like depression in younger people is a lot more overlooked than depression in older people and adults.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your host, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW.
And we're back now. And Zach, I think we were talking about, you know, your depression and teen depression. What else would you like to add to it as far as, like, because I know you mentioned breakup of the family. Can you kind of maybe give us a little insight into how you feel like that led to depression?
It makes you feel, it's oftentimes a feeling that can't really be described. It's, you know, especially for me, as humans, we naturally like to compare. And for me, it was especially being really young, I would look at other families, I would look at other friends, things like that, like, oh, look at that family, you know, they're happy, they're together, they get to do things together. That wasn't really mine. You know, my parents got divorced when I was 3 years old, so, you know, I was oftentimes with my grandpa, or, you know, my mom works 12-hour shifts, so it's like when my mom did come home, I didn't really get to do a lot with her either. It was, in a sense, I really didn't have much family in the way that we see a conventional family working together. There was no, like, all right, let's sit down for dinner. There is no dinner. You know, there wasn't then, there isn't now. It's like you just eat when you want to eat. There is no really family unit to that. So.
And I think that's a growing thing that we see nowadays. And I think that a lot of times now, parents are so busy, they don't have the time. What advice would you give? Or if the parents just simply think, oh, he's sad, but he's okay, he's playing his video games, is there something that they can do to maybe help the situation?
I think parents need to learn to be more aware of signs, red flags. I think parents also need to be more aware that it can happen. I think a lot of parents look at it as like, oh, okay, there's kids out there that are depressed, but that could never be my kid.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I think that, like, when the red flags are there, I feel like sometimes some parents kind of go into a state of denial in the sense of like, oh, that's not really what's going on here. Like, we're going to be okay. We can get around this. But I don't really think that's true. It's like, you know, especially like for me, like, you know, you sit at home and you play Xbox 10 hours a day. I mean, that puts a flag up right there. Mm-hmm. It's like most teenage kids, all right, they're going out, they're hanging with their friends. Maybe mm-hmm. they'll go to a few parties, you know, big into sports. That wasn't me.
You and I've talked a lot about trauma just on the side and how that can manifest itself into depression. And one of the things is trust is such a big deal. And if we're always on this on-the-go life, you know, you've mentioned before with me and on our talks that if we can't trust people in the small things, then how are we going to open up to you with the big things? And if you're running through the house, parents are running through, caregivers, whomever, and we're telling them little things and they're barely hearing us, how are we going to be able to open up to those big things, such as what we're talking about now?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely gets challenging because, like, you know, that's something that, like, I think we've talked about before in terms of, like, parents saying, like, oh, yeah, you can always come to me with
right.
this. Or, like, you know.
And which I'm sure they mean.
We always talk about that. And I'm sure they do mean
yeah.
that. But I think the problem is, like, there has to be that level of consistency. Because a lot of it, too, is, like, if you say you're not going to get mad, then don't get mad. You know what I mean? You kind of have to follow through with that. Because especially when you're dealing with something like this, it's very delicate. You kind of have to tiptoe, in a sense.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but how much education for the parents do you think is an important role as well? Because, I mean, if you're a teenager and, like you say, you can go to your parents and you tell them you're depressed,
mm-hmm.
how do they know what to do if they've never experienced it with a child or themselves or a family member? How do they get well educated, either one of you guys, anybody?
Well, I think the parents, for the biggest part, is kind of what Zach is alluding to, or just having this conversation, is to listen. Be very present. You know, as a parent, the last thing you want to see is your child hurt. You just want to reach in and pull it out. Well, you can't.
Mm-hmm.
You just be there with them and talk with them and let them know that you are truly present and accepting and non-judgmental.
And not try to fix it.
No, you can't.
You can't, right, totally.
Yeah.
And the parents, like you said, I'm sorry, go ahead, Zach.
No, I was going to say, I think part of it, too, is like, emotional support. I think listening is very important. Sometimes you don't have to do a lot, but rather show your support and be there for them. And, you know, I at least for me, I think even small acts that not even just in terms of words, I mean, words are great, but actually showing it, you know, you love your kid, give them a hug, you know, things like that. I feel like small acts go a long way in kind of reinforcing the mind that, like, okay, these people do care about me. I think words, they're good, but I think actions go a lot further.
Because I think that's where, you know, starting from birth to where we are today is adolescent males, Zach sitting here, is that we grow up knowing something's off, not knowing how to put words to it. And, you know, that's a very difficult thing for a child, that they don't know how to talk about how they're feeling, although they know something's wrong. And I think for parents to look for those signs, you know, like in school, if your grades all of a sudden dip, if you're secluding yourself more, not much as words as actions.
And I think that from hearing both of you and just thinking about the society and the time and age we live in now, engaging with your kids. Kids will often say they prefer to play the Xbox than go out to an event or to the park. Play basketball. However, once they go and they do those things and they engage, it often lifts their spirits. So I think the more engagement that the parents can do, I agree with Zach, you know, the words are just words. Checking in here and there might make the parent feel better, but I don't think it does much for the kid. So I think involvement is important as much as possible.
And I think the communication, you guys can tell me what you think, when you're speaking to your child, the conversation needs to be more than, hey, how was your day? Okay, great.
Yeah.
Glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Not so
yeah.
superficial.
And be genuine. Genuine
yeah.
is the key. And a lot of times, too, parents would be like, well, I do ask them. They don't talk to me. They just keep going. But I think the common denominator needs to be they need to know you're being genuine.
Mm-hmm.
Even if they don't want to talk to you or they don't feel like talking or they'd rather play Fortnite or a game instead of engaging with the family, if they know you're genuine and you are truly there, That makes a huge difference.
Yeah, it can't be cookie cutter. It can't be like, hey, how was your day? Hey, how are you feeling? Like, that's useless. That doesn't do anything. You know what I mean? That it has to be genuine, and it has to, you know, that's the thing too, is those questions oftentimes I feel like, you know, should change based on the scenario. You know what I mean? It's like if you see your kids down, okay, maybe they want to talk about it, maybe they don't. But you can't ask the same cookie cutter questions and expect things to get better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. And I think it's like you say, because if I keep asking my child, hey, how was your day? Hey, how was your day? Then I'm going to get the same response back all the time as well, you know. So, yeah, I think mixing it up a little bit with questions. And actually, I think what Dave said really hits the nail on the head. Be sincere and show the concern that you have for your child. And I guess my question also, though, Dave, as a clinician, is it okay for the parent to ask their child, hey, are you depressed? Can you tell me how you're feeling?
Well, I think, yeah, for them, because if you already feel that your child is depressed or going through a hard time, odds are you're right.
Okay.
So being able to just be genuine, real, and ask them that question, and that could go a long way. They may say no, but that's okay. Just be there with them. And let's throw it out there, Earl and Benny. Depression can be draining on the caregivers. Mm-hmm. It can be draining, and we want to be sensitive to that. But the people that are in a depression aren't doing it for, you know, the mere purpose of look at me or give me attention. This is real.
Right. And I guess my question for you as well, though, Dave, because you say that if you suspect that your child's suffering from depression, to ask them, and if they say, no, I'm okay, what do you do if your gut tells you as a parent, there's something going on with my child, and I've asked them, and they still won't tell me? What's your options
then? Well, I think, you once again, you stay to consistency. You don't want to push, because anytime you push someone, they're going to push back. And Zach may be able to talk a lot more to this question than I, being a teenage young man. I mean, Zach, so I'm going to kick this to you.
I would offer something different. I would say I would say it would be a bad idea to ask your child, hey, are you depressed? And I think coming from my experience, number one, like Mr. Yonke said, first of all, chances are they're going to deny it. And by asking the question and then them having to deny it to kind of avoid the consequences or the parents' reaction or being fearful of what might happen, they're going to in turn end up shutting the parent out more. I know that happened with me. I've seen that happen to other people. Because, you know, when that question's asked, it's like, okay, are you depressed? What are you going through? And then they say no. They kind of have to reinforce that. And the only way to do that is to not let the parents see their emotions. Otherwise, their lie doesn't make sense. Like, I couldn't say, okay, no, I'm fine, and then be around the parent and be depressed all the time. It's like, okay, give it 2 days and the parent knows I'm lying. So for me to kind of keep up with that lie, I have to avoid the parent to therefore be like, kind of make them think, oh, okay, maybe he is okay.
I think most people, if you ask them that question, they don't want to pull you down. They want to make you feel like everything's fine, so they won't give you the genuine answer if they're going through it. But I think we need to look at nonverbal. Nonverbal communication is so much powerful than verbal communication. So you want to look at their stance, how they're alienating or isolating themselves. If they're on video games for 10 hours, that's a long time to be on a video game. And it might not be entertaining. It might be a way to preoccupy them from feeling and going into that. So it's a way for them to separate. But I think you have to pick up on those cues, the nonverbal cues.
And also, I guess, Dave, as the clinician again, are the signs and symptoms of a teenager going through depression and an adult going through depression the same, or are there different things you need to look for with each?
I think Benny opened the conversation to that one. I think anger, anger is a big one for teenagers.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to cut you off. But can you tell me why the anger plays a role in the depression, or Zach?
Well, Zach, go ahead. You want to kick that
one? I know I have a lot of inward anger, a lot. And I think that I feel like part of that, too, is because with depression, right, like you get very, very sad. The problem is when you start to get very, very sad, oftentimes it's difficult to pinpoint why. Because with depression, oftentimes You're upset literally for no reason. You don't know why you're upset. You're just upset. Mm-hmm. You're sad. You don't feel good. That turns into a lot of frustration because it's like, okay, I don't know why I'm upset. And then you almost start to get angry at yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get angry at yourself, I mean, you can only keep it, you know, balled up for so long. Eventually that comes out. So then you start taking that out on other people.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have anger towards other people. You know, hey, Zach, can you go vacuum the stairs? Leave me alone. You know, that anger starts to come out for other people and things like that.
It's weird, though, because then it doesn't look like depression.
Yeah,
it looks like opposition anger.
Well, anger, I think, is a big one. Anger is a relationship that most teenagers have.
Mm-hmm.
They have a relationship with anger, and depression is not something that is still able to put words to or be like, hey, you know, hey, my serotonin's low this evening, and I think that I need maybe thinking of medication or getting some therapy, and that would help. They don't know that,
mm-hmm.
but they do know anger. And, you know, you're kind of opening up that a little bit. We haven't even got into neurology yet in the adolescent years,
mm-hmm.
and how the brain is maturing and changing and the chemicals that go with that. So I think that that is an educational piece that parents need to educate themselves
Absolutely.
On.
Where do they go for that education, though, Dave?
Well, there's a lot of places that you can
besides
do
Google.
Yeah, Google, yeah. Yeah, because go to Facebook, girl.
Yeah.
They know everything. I think, you know, reputable sites. You know, you got very reputable sites, webs, Wikipedias. They're reputable.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, reading in a way of understanding the prefrontal lobe, the executive functionings, the neurology of it, the chemicals that are changing. You know, I think it's a very big piece that we miss in this field.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we as therapists need to do a better job of communicating that out.
Educating.
Well. Yeah, educating. Yeah. I mean, Zach, do you have anything to add to that on yourself? I mean, because that's something that Zach and I just really getting into is talking about the neurology. Because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a geek on it. I read too much on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing is hopefully I can impart some wisdom to Zach in that area.
Right.
Let me ask you, though, because when we talk about neurology, everybody wants to jump to medication. And I guess my take on medication has always been, if you're depressed, let's give you some medication so then you can actually start talking about the depression. Because, I mean, if I'm so depressed I can't even talk about it, how am I going to get better?
Well, you have to be careful with medication. Number one is that, and I know Zach's going to want to jump in on this one. I want to get you there. But medication, one, you have to be careful with somebody who's truly depressed. Because many times when you're truly depressed, you don't even have the energy to commit suicide. Sounds crazy, but true.
Mm-hmm.
You give somebody some medication without good therapy, now you have a severely depressed person with energy.
Mm-hmm.
Through neurology, the brain is very plastic. Through therapy, the research has proven over and over and over again
mm-hmm.
that the brain can rewire itself to certain environmental things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, certainly, medication, in my opinion, can be an option,
mm-hmm.
but certainly not the first option.
Mm-hmm.
Zach?
Yeah, that's an experience I've had. You know, I've been offered medication. I have turned it down, though.
Mm-hmm.
I don't take medication. I don't want to. I think part of that, too, is maybe me being a little bit strong-headed. I want to know that if I get through it, I got through it on my own,
mm-hmm.
not with the help of, like, oh, okay, this drug. I think part of it, too, is for somebody that hasn't taken medication before and they're first going into it, I think there is a little bit of fear in the sense that, like, okay, what if I become almost, like, reliant on this? Like,
mm-hmm.
this is how I solve my issues is, okay, I take this drug, I solve my issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really something that I wanted to look at that way. I want it to be more of like, okay, I want to fix me because I fixed me,
mm-hmm.
not because some drug fixed me.
Let me ask you,
I feel like there is some fear in that.
Yeah, let me ask you this, because I have a lot of clients who are opposed to medicine, but maybe open to therapy. Were you more open to therapy? Was that a possibility for you when you were younger, or did that come later?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I started therapy when I was very young, even at the very, very beginning to deal with, like, even the divorce, like, with my mother, like,
mm-hmm.
very, very young. I can't even remember how young, maybe 6, 7, 8
okay.
years old. Very young. So, I mean, therapy has been something that's been around, like, my entire life,
mm-hmm.
up and on. You know, I have it now. I had it for a while back, then I stopped. It's been off and on. But, you know, that is something that's a lot more, because part of that too is that's not something physically going into your body, changing your body.
Mm-hmm.
I think therapy is a lot more comforting in the sense that, especially too, if somebody's really depressed and doesn't get very much interaction with other people,
mm-hmm.
now you actually get to see somebody face to face. You get to talk to them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that person is going to listen. You know, that's their job. They actually have to listen and think. And I feel like that's relief in a sense
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that person listens.
Mm-hmm.
Does there come a point where, okay, I'm done with therapy, or from your perspective, because I know you said you've been to therapy and then you quit for a while, do you get to a point where you feel good and you don't need the therapy and then maybe later on you need to go back?
I think for some people that's a need.
Okay.
Not for me.
Okay.
I think that I stopped for a while because either the therapist I was with just wasn't really working for me or things like that. And that's part of it too, is like when it comes to a therapist, it is a very close relationship
mm-hmm.
in the sense that you're opening up and you're very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to expose a lot to that person. And especially, you know, if you're first meeting that person, it's like, all right, you're a random guy or a
right.
random girl. All right, let's open up to you. So that can be a little bit challenging. So you definitely have to connect with the person. That's why it was on and off for me. I had
mm-hmm.
to kind of find that person that I connected
mm-hmm.
with.
I think that's the hardest part, is being vulnerable. Because you have to be open, and you have to go there, and it's really scary if you don't trust the person, if you don't know the person.
And how easy was it for you, or did you tell the therapist, hey, this isn't working, or did you just quit going? Because I always encourage clients, you know, if after a while you don't feel like we're clicking, you let me know so I can help you find someone who will work for you. Were you able to do that, or did you just stop going?
So for the first therapist, I did do that. And it was not the first one when I was younger, but the first one that we didn't really click. I did do that. It wasn't really that productive for me. It was like, okay, she kind of tried her thing. And, you know, for lack of better words, I thought it was just kind of a weak effort. So I was like, okay, so I stopped with that. And then for the second one, I was like, okay, this didn't really work the first time. It caused more tension. I was like, let's avoid that. So
mm-hmm.
I just kind of stopped.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that I found interesting, very interesting, is you kind of found a way to deal with that depression. You kind of found a way to, I mean, therapy helped. I heard you say that. But what else did you find that helped you?
For me, the real relief was music. So for me, that was kind of my thing. I've listened to music since I was very young. I still listen to music now. It's kind of almost laughable amongst my friends. I mean, everywhere I go, you can't find me without earbuds. I have
mm-hmm.
earbuds now. I have earbuds everywhere I go. I have to have them. It's kind of like, it's weird for me. It's almost like I disassociate. Like when I put in the music, it's like, I'm gone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm no longer really in this world. I'm almost kind of somewhere else. It's,
mm-hmm.
And it works for me. You know, that's kind of my thing.
It speaks to you.
It does.
Probably unlike anyone else that spoke to you.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, yeah, I think that that's what, you know, Zach hit on a few minutes ago. There's no cookie cutter here.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, you build a trusting relationship with the client or, you know, with them. And then you tailor that therapy to who they are. You know, whether it's for me, I very much get into a kind of a Buddhistic psychoanalytic bend,
mm-hmm.
Where you bring depression and all of it together versus other types of therapy where you're trying to extract the depression.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to know the client to know what's going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to also move forward, I know we talked a little bit about depression and kind of touched on suicide. How often does suicide and depression go hand in hand? Do you have a clue?
Oh, I think it's very much married to me, depression and suicide. Now, there's the majority of depressed people are not going to commit suicide, but there are a good percentage who will.
Mm-hmm.
Once too many.
How do you distinguish between the depressed client who is going to attempt suicide and the one who's not? Is there any way as a therapist?
Well, that's going to take that's a lot of training. That's not something I would want just one of our listeners without the knowledge and training to go out and do. I think for our listeners, the biggest thing for them to do is question and help to get the that person, their son, their friend, whomever, get them to a professional that can assess the correct way.
And you mentioned questioning. Is it appropriate to ask a depressed person who you feel might be suicidal, hey, are you feeling suicidal? Or should we kind of approach it with kid gloves, like, hey, I know you're not feeling well?
Well, every bit of research, for the most part, is, let's say, suicide. Call it suicide because that's what we're talking about. But, whoa, that's taboo, isn't it, Zach? We don't want to say that word, do we, Zach?
Yeah.
You know, but I think, to me, and I want Zach to piggyback here, agree or not with me, suicide, we need to use the name. And I think it's more important for our trained professionals to be able to assess this. Now, gatekeeper trainings and that sort of thing, I think those are for our teachers, our parents, the non-professionals in the field to be trained in a sense to get young men and women to us.
Well, in the gatekeeper training that you mentioned, those are more like a brief kind of question per se, persuade.
Yeah, and respond.
Respond.
Right.
Yeah, totally. And refer.
Right. Yeah. And it gives the layperson some tools where they don't feel like, you know, a boxer with a standing eight count. You know, it gives somebody some tools to use, and with those tools comes some confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that for the layperson, that would be the biggest thing, because you don't want to jump a layperson into trying to do therapy for someone that's suicidal. You want to jump in there, Zach, and give me your opinion?
So I think that, like, I think it is important to actually ask the person, you know, like, are you suicidal? But I think also with asking kind of before, where we talked about, like, asking the person if they're depressed, I think the two kind of go, you got to be careful with that, because it's like, if they are going to lie about it, you may be putting them in more harm than good. Because, you know, if they do end up lying about it, they're, you know, you're going to start that separation again. It's like, now you have somebody who's not only depressed, but also suicidal, and they're pulling away from you. I mean, that's a recipe for disaster. That's not good.
I think that goes back, Earl, to the gatekeeper question. You know, ask, persuade, respond. That gets them to the professional, where Zach just hit on something in our credo of the field. We never do more harm than good. And you do not want a lay person doing more harm, like Zach just said, that it just ends up pushing them to another way where they all talk about it.
And I just want to give our listeners a number. If someone is battling depression and feeling suicidal, the number, the suicide hotline, is 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255. And there's someone there 24 hours that can speak with you, listen to you, help you deal and work through whatever you're going through.
Right. And I think it's really important also, if you have a loved one who you feel might be suicidal, don't just sit back and, you know, let them do their own thing. Reach out to someone to find out, like Dave said, get a gatekeeper training or something like that to know how to respond.
Well, yeah, and for that parent or whomever we're talking about, Earl, go talk to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
You go get, you know, go get some, so you, where you can get your, you bounce some things off, some questions, some thoughts. You know, that's not always going to the young man or young woman who's depressed or suicide. If you're uncomfortable, go to someone, and like any good therapist would do in a session that's stuck, we go get supervision.
Mm-hmm.
Go get supervision.
Mm-hmm. And that also gives the parent a little bit of an outner as well as to what's going on with their child, I guess.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, if we talk about emotions, how emotional would it be? I can only imagine how emotional it is for family members to see a loved one that wants to hurt themselves, commit suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How is that question, when it's presented to someone who's dealing with this, is it a fear? I would imagine it is a fear to say yes, if you're feeling that way. So how do you think someone who's dealing with it commonly responds?
I feel like the most natural response would be to lie.
Okay.
If you do lie, because if you lie about it, you're going to, you're going to end up avoiding the consequences of it. You know what I mean? Like, if somebody asks you, are you suicidal, and you say yes, all right, then you're thinking, all right, now I got to brace myself. Okay, what are they going to do now? Are they going to take me to a therapist? Am I going to go to the hospital? Mm-hmm. What's going to happen? You know, I feel like because we want to avoid that,
mm-hmm.
it's better to just avoid it altogether. Be like, no, I'm fine.
Well, mm-hmm. Doc, let me ask you a question. We met for 5 minutes together, probably, mm-hmm. what, maybe a few months ago?
Yep.
Within the first few minutes, what was it about me that you were so comfortable to tell me?
I think that it's very weird. It's hard to describe. A lot of it's a gut feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It's very like...
And this isn't about me. I want people to know, because I was humbled when mm-hmm. you said, you told me within a few minutes.
Yeah.
I'm very humbled by that. Now, this isn't about me.
Yeah.
It's about helping others know what was in you that thought, hey...
I think a big part of it is compassion. I think that's a really, really big part of it, is a lot of people talk about it,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people may think they have it, but in terms of actually showing that,
mm-hmm.
and in terms of the execution is often poor. I think that, like, and that's a big thing for me, too, is, like, compassion. Just basic things, you know, people talking to you, asking
mm-hmm.
how you're doing, you know, just basic conversations.
Genuinely concerned.
Yeah, things like that. And not only that, but I think also, like, treat it in some senses as if the person didn't have depression, as if they're just another person,
mm-hmm.
an average person, an average friend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can talk to them about things, you know, joke around with them, have fun, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess with compassion also comes back to what you said as well, with that, when you sense someone who has compassion for you,
mm-hmm.
you can open up and feel trusting toward
for
that
sure.
person. And that's
yeah.
where trust comes in, like
for
you mentioned
sure.
earlier, which I think is really important.
For sure.
So, yeah. But
and
I
think also when you experience depression and when you experience anxiety, you see it in other people before they tell you about it. It's something that you can kind of sense. I know
mm-hmm.
it's been that way for me. I feel like that's why I've reached out to certain people and things like that, because it's like you can see the signs better than anybody else, because
mm-hmm.
it's like, well, you're going through it.
Mm-hmm.
You see, you know, what everybody else sees is like, oh, okay, they're just playing Xbox or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It clicks with you because it's like, okay, I know what's going on.
Right,
you
right.
You know what I mean? And I feel like that's how it was, like, with you,
yeah.
for example. Like, it was something that, like, I could see. You know, and part of it, too, is, you know, I got to learn about some of your experiences
mm-hmm.
and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I talked to Zach about my dealings with depression and suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And it became just a really flowing conversation
yeah.
between us.
Mm-hmm.
And also, as far as, like, a suicide attempt or a completion of suicide, I've always heard, you know, that it's a selfish act. What are your thoughts about that?
People that are in a suicidal state of mind, there's no logic to it. No logic whatsoever. I understand, though, when someone says that, because that is coming from a loving place where they're at, a caring place, a frustrating place. And although I get it, suicide is not a logical thinking.
Yeah, and
when I look at suicide, I think a big part of it is when you think about a selfish act, it's a lot of it has to do with being consciously aware, right? A lot of it has to do with being consciously aware of the fact that you're hurting the other person, but yet you still don't care and you're going to follow through anyway.
Mm-hmm.
With suicide, I don't really think you can say that's the case, because it's like, well, you know, if you're going to follow through with committing suicide, you're not sitting there thinking, okay, I'm going to hurt my mother, I'm going to hurt my family, but you know what, screw them, I'm going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the thought process. I don't really think selfish is the right word. I think that, there's not a lot of thinking to it.
Well,
yeah,
when you said you feel alone, I would mm-hmm. think, and again, help me, if you're suicidal, if you're at that point, and you feel alone, you don't think about other people. You
no,
feel
you
like,
don't.
It's me.
You know.
Right.
Well, if there's anything selfish about it, you want to live.
Mm-hmm.
The selfish part of someone that's suicidal is they don't want to die.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They want the pain to go away.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you can look, research, talk, anyone, look at the hardest of heart on death row. When they get ready to be executed, they don't want to die.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not, suicide isn't a matter of wanting to die. Suicide is a matter of wanting the pain go away. And the pain goes away by having the conversations like we're having tonight.
Right. And I think that's a great distinction you made, the difference between wanting to die as opposed to just wanting the pain to go away. Mm-hmm. I think that's real important. If nobody, you don't take anything else from this, I think that's one thing to take as well.
Yeah, because, you know, the pain will subside.
Mm-hmm.
Take it from someone who's been there. Zach, it is not humanly possible to stay in a state of depression without getting some relief. It's just not humanly possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Dave, it's like you said, and you guys both can speak to this. That's thinking logically.
Yes.
Okay, and so
yes.
Within the suicidal mind, you're not thinking that way.
No, but it also goes back to the conversations we're having tonight.
Right.
Hearing from a young man that was depressed,
mm-hmm.
and hearing from maybe, hopefully, a therapist that was depressed,
mm-hmm.
that during those moments of darkness, you just want it to go away.
Mm-hmm.
But if you have people to reach out to that you know will truly listen and be there, that goes light years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the most important things. You ask Zach, why me? Why'd you open up to me?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, one thing about our profession is we are not supposed to judge. And I think when someone tells you that, the first thing they think is, once I make this known, I'm going to the hospital.
Yeah.
Something's going to happen.
Right, right.
But if the person can stay present,
mm-hmm.
and listen,
yeah.
and support, then you feel more comfortable to open up about those things.
But then you hit on something spot on. Stay present.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
We want to jump to a fix.
Right.
Stay present.
Right.
Be there.
I think that's what they're scared of, is you trying to jump to a fix.
Right.
Don't jump to the fix.
Right.
Stay here
just
with me.
Listen
to me. Yeah.
And so it's more important for you to allow the client to come up with the fix instead of you trying to fix it for them. And I guess by being present, you allow them to process mm-hmm. through what's going on. Zach, I see you shaking your head.
Yeah, for sure. I've seen that way too many times. People like try and fix you almost.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's some like malfunction in
mm-hmm.
you. You know what I mean? Like we have to fix this, and then we're gonna tweak this. It doesn't really work like that. I think it's more of going back to the emotional support thing. I think by being there and listening, you're going to do a lot of help compared
mm-hmm.
to trying to be like, and that's kind of why, you know, going back to medicine, I saw medicine as that fix.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that was just kind of thrown out.
A quick fix.
Here you go.
Here's
the fix. Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of plays into that fix thing. That doesn't really, it's not very effective.
Well, there's two levels here we're talking about when people become suicidal or depressed. When people are in a suicidal depression, they are in an emotional tailspin. You want to be present with those emotions and then slowly get them back up to their intellect.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the intellect is where you think logically.
Mm-hmm.
In an emotional state, you're all over the place. One little trick maybe would be to ask what questions. When we ask what questions, it gets us thinking.
Mm-hmm.
If we ask, you know, the one always, I don't laugh, but as a therapist, I laugh. If someone's suicidal
mm-hmm.
depression at one time, I laugh, is when somebody says, why do you want to commit suicide?
Yeah.
Well, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't. So what is going on in your life right
mm-hmm.
now that if one thing could change, what would that be to
mm-hmm.
help you feel better?
Mm-hmm.
The whats are drawing you out.
Yeah, and also when you ask a why question, sometimes it's taken as accusatory as well
mm-hmm.
by the client. You know, why? You know, because
yeah.
by asking why do you want to take your life, you're making a big assumption that you're a bad person for wanting
yeah.
to do that.
Right, and as the helper, you know, we have to know where we're at with it. The
mm-hmm.
one thing I talked about, Zach, tonight about coming on this show before we did was I had to know Zach was not in this for his own therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Zach is, obviously, when we talk about it, it helps us. We've said that.
Mm-hmm.
But Zach is in that place now where he wants to help others.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a distinction there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A huge distinction.
Yeah, I think part of what you said, too, and you can probably talk about this from your own experience regarding, like, the tailspin, is,
mm-hmm.
like, part of it, too, is, like, you may get better, but it never leaves you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, depression is something that always stays with you. It's in the back of your mind. And even if you get better, you kind of have to worry, too, because, like, if you do get hope, you do get better, is something going to happen that, like, sets you right back into it? You know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? Like, you may be happy, you may be better, but there's still there's still some bits of depression that are left.
Mm-hmm.
It's never fully gone from your life. Okay, now I'm a normal, happy person. That's not the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's always going to be there to some extent, whether that's an hour when you're home alone
mm-hmm.
or whether that's just a rough day at work or whatever. There's always some lurkings of depression that are still going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's fearful of, okay, when is that going to set off? And that
mm-hmm.
doesn't really leave you, no matter how much better you get.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where, and Zach and I, when we have conversations like this, you know, we look at depression as our friend now.
Yeah.
As a part of us. It's who we are. We're okay with that.
How did you get to that point, either one of you guys? Zach, how did you get to the point where, as Dave puts it, depression is our friend?
I think the best way of putting it is once you kind of realize it's not leaving, you got two options. You can either fight it and you're literally going to dig your own grave.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, almost literally.
Mm-hmm.
You can either do that or you can kind of look at it as, okay, I live with this. I deal with it. Let's find a way to kind of walk with it, which is weird that, you know, we do phrase it that way. It's like, okay, depression is our friend. It's like, it's kind of
oxymoronic.
Yeah.
But I like it. I think it's good.
It's kind of the friend that you hate. It's annoying, but it's always around. And, you know, and I think part of it, too, that we actually talked about, one of the first times we met, that's very interesting, is a lot of people with depression are almost fearful of what would happen if they do overcome it, because that's all they know.
It kind of gives you an identity.
Yeah.
But that's where we can't get stuck there, because that's feeling sorry for ourselves. But like Zach said, there's an identity, but we become friends with it in a sense that there's attributes that Zach, as he gets older, is going to see. He is going to understand human behavior light years ahead of the typical person who's never dealt with certain situations.
I like the analogy you use about how if you fight it, you're literally digging your own grave. How did you get to a point where you, and I'm going to use my own word, accept that you have depression? Because that's what it sounds like it really is when you say it's my friend. You've kind of accepted it's there with you. How do you get to that point?
Well, I think what we do, Earl, is, you know, as we've alluded to throughout the show, is we have taken depression out and we push it away, we pack it away. The trick is you go to it. You come, you meld with it, you mesh with it. And that goes kind of back to that Buddhistic psychoanalytic theory
mm-hmm.
that I've started to really go with in my work
mm-hmm.
is we marry it in a sort of
mm-hmm.
way, and we understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So when it does come knocking for a visit, we have the skills, we have the tools to keep it at bay while understanding what's going on.
Can I ask? I want to ask a question. So because I understand how the depression can be a part of your life and you can become accustomed to it, does the suicide also become a part of your life, or can you divorce? Can that decrease? Can that cease to exist?
Yes, without a doubt. I can speak for me on this. I'm not an extremist by any means. I think 100%. I think zero tolerance. I think a lot of that's crazy. But for me to say it's the closest I'll come to zero tolerance and extremity by telling you it will never happen again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for me to explain why.
Mm-hmm.
My next question.
So,
go ahead, though, Zach.
So I'd like to hear Zach on that.
Yeah, so for me, I think it's a little bit different.
Okay.
I think the two are I think that the suicide can separate a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but I think once you've kind of been to that dark place, it's very hard to get past. It's very
mm-hmm.
hard to forget. I don't really think you can forget. You know,
mm-hmm.
I know I never will. You probably never
will.
I
don't think that.
And I think that, like, and I think that part of it, too, is once you've been there and those two were kind of meshed together for so long,
mm-hmm.
I think trying to separate them is very difficult. You may think about it less, but it's like they're together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, eventually, at least for me, you know, when you go through depression and you go through the loops and things like that, you may have brief thoughts of suicide. Now, what are the severity of those?
Mm-hmm.
Not nearly as bad as before,
okay.
But I don't think for me you could ever truly separate
okay.
them.
Okay.
I don't think I could do that.
But severity is very, very important.
Yeah.
So if you can get that severity lower,
yeah.
that's
And Zach has the skills now when he gets to that place, if he were
right,
to get back
right.
to that place. The support system's there yeah. for him now. The people recognize Zach can put words to
right.
it. Zach is very educated. Zach can put words to it. So Zach's going to reach out and get the help.
That's a big part of it, too, is like once you have those support systems,
mm-hmm.
you do kind of realize it's like it's relieving to a degree that, like, okay, it can get bad, but if it does get bad, I have an outlet somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So it's like that's very true in the sense that, like, if I do get to that place, I have to – and that's where you have to be careful. It's like if I do get to that place, I have to maintain enough cognitive ability to know, okay – let's go find the support system
mm-hmm.
instead of kind of the breakdown, which we were talking earlier, where it's like you lose all logical thought, you just start spiraling, and then the suicidal thoughts come in and all that, and that's where you end up in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're able to kind of maintain it early, when
mm-hmm.
you kind of feel it catch on, like, okay, let's realize that we have options here,
mm-hmm.
that's when you're going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Once you kind of get deep into it and you lose the logic, once you lose the logic, you're kind of in trouble.
Right.
So I hear you saying that you can feel it coming on. Is that right? You kind of think,
sure.
oh, wow, this is coming on. I
yeah.
need to do something. Okay,
for
that's
sure.
cool.
So, like, sometimes it can be sudden.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, that – when it's sudden, it's often not as bad when it's sudden. Like, for instance, like, if you go to, in terms of severity, it's bad in terms of the impact, but in terms of how bad the depression is, it's often less, you know what I mean? Like, if I go to school or if I'm at a practice and something upsets me and it just really messes with me for, like, a week, yes, it was sudden, but it's like, okay, I'll get over whatever happened at practice or whatever it was in a week, and I'll be fine.
And that's the I think, you know, at the end of the day, Zach has found hope. Zach is, his skills are to a place now where if it does knock on, if his friend knocks, he knows there's hope. He has the skills. He's talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
He has a support system. He has great people around him.
Mm-hmm.
Because hope at the end of the day is what's going to pull not only a depressed, suicidal person through, but the vast percentage of the rest of us.
Yeah, right.
There's hope.
Right.
Never lose your hope.
Well, I think what you're doing too, Zach, by doing this podcast with us and speaking your truth, is you're giving other people hope. I really
mm-hmm.
do. And I really appreciate you coming in, because I know there are millions of people
mm-hmm.
who relate, really do. And it's hard to talk about. It's difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So I commend you. Thank you.
The thing with hope is I think you really have to focus on something that you know won't leave you,
mm-hmm.
because you don't want to give yourself false hope, because
mm-hmm.
if you give yourself false hope, then, you know, you're going to be really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's funny, like with me, for instance, with it being music, music can't leave me, you know
mm-hmm.
what I mean? Music can't get up and walk away. So you want to be able to find something that gives you hope that you know will be there. You
mm-hmm.
know, don't put too much hope in other people. What
right.
if that person leaves you? You know,
right.
then you're in trouble. So when it comes to hope, really focus on something that matters to you
mm-hmm.
and that's going to stick with you and won't leave. You know, that could be a sport, exercise, music, whatever it is. You want to find something like that.
Right.
And I'm so proud of this young man sitting beside me.
I also want to say, besides what Benny said about you coming on here, Zach, I think the important thing is you've given a voice to teenagers who have depression or suicide. You've kind of gotten the word out there that it's not just a teenage mood thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing like
no.
that. It's a legit psychological. Yeah,
much,
it's a legit psychological disorder. So, yeah. So, guys, I want to say thanks so much for coming. And like I say, if you liked what you heard, listen to it on the podcast if you'd like. And we'll be back next week with another exciting episode of On the Couch.
This is On the Couch, your connection to the world of mental health. Exploring all things related to daily living. Your hosts, Benny Massey, LPCC, and Earl J. Bell, LCSW. J. Bell, LCSW.